Chapter 6. By the time James Abrenio was cleared for an audience with United States Attorney Sandra Grosvenor, he'd been forced to kill nearly 90 minutes in a cramped waiting room on a butt-killing wooden chair. Abrenio hadn't seen her in close to 10 years, but Grosvenor's reputation as a queen bitch had traveled all the way to Michigan, and apparently every word was true. He'd agreed to take on this assignment as a favor to her to honor their friendship from law school, but he'd not signed on for being shown disrespect. "What the hell, Sandra?" After this much time in the wings, he wanted his opener to be a showstopper. "You called me, remember?" "Not for this," Grosvenor said. She remained focused on writing notes on a legal brief, a fast scrawl using a gilded black-and-white fountain pen. Abrenio took a step closer. "Holland, Michigan is a very nice place. I have a thriving practice there. I don't need this bullshit. When I say I need to see you, I need to see you." "Yet you have time to squander on a pointless rant." She still had not looked up from her work. Abrenio yanked one of the wooden guest chairs from the edge of her desk and dropped onto the seat. "The Kendall children are missing," he said. He fired the words like a punch. Grosvenor's hand stopped writing, but she took a few seconds to look up. "How do you know?" "I called Resurrection House. Their car was attacked on the way there, and the boys never arrived." Grosvenor said, "Huh." Then she looked back down. "Anything else?" Abrenio slapped the desk. "Look at me, goddammit! Why are you being so difficult?" After a dramatic sigh and an even more dramatic sag of her shoulders, Grosvenor capped her fountain pen and placed it atop the legal brief she'd been editing. She adjusted it so that the barrel of the pen was precisely parallel to the edge of the paper. That done, she placed her folded hands on her desk. "Is this better?" she asked. "I could do without the patronizing bullshit, but yes, it's better." Abrenio leaned in closer. "They were kidnapped, Sandra. When were you going to tell me?"
"There is no evidence of a kidnapping."
"Their car was attacked, for God's sake. At least 2 people were shot. One of them used to be a cop." Grosvenor scowled as she parsed words in her head.
"Yes," she said. "A car was attacked, and at least 2 people might have been shot, among them a social worker. The kidnapping part, as I understand it, is hearsay at best. There's no physical evidence."
"2 missing boys are not evidence."
"Yes, they are evidence of 2 boys not being where we thought they were going to be. What do you want from me, James?" "The locals searched the area, found nothing. My money says it's some kind of administrative snafu. They got sent to a different facility and the paperwork hasn't had a chance to catch up. In any case, it's not our problem."
Abrenio leaned in closer still, his midsection pressing against the front edge of her desk.
"But it is our problem. Connie Kendall won't consider a word of what you're offering until she knows that her children are safe."
"Okay," Grosvenor said.
"Tell her they're safe."
Abrenio recoiled into the seatback cushion.
"No, Sandra, no. We can't do that. You know the stakes here as well as I do. The C-Squared took those kids and murdered a cop. Christ, they shot a priest. Those are not federal crimes, James. Get with the program."
"Oh, come on, Sandra. You're asking me to lie to my client."
"It's not a lie, James." Her voice crescendoed. "You are assuming that harm has come to those boys. You are assuming facts, not in evidence. The real lie would be for you to tell Mrs. Kendall that her children are in danger. I suppose you can honestly tell her that we've lost track of them, but what would be the point of that?"
"She's their mother," Grosvenor shouted. "She's my detainee. 80% of prisoners all over the world are parents, James. If they wanted to be good ones, they wouldn't have become criminals.
You say she won't accept a deal that will save her life unless she knows that the children are safe. Well, good for her. I don't care.
How very prosecutorial of you, Abrenio said. May I remind you that I am her defense lawyer.
And as such, you owe it to your client to save her life.
Grosvenor was clearly tired of the pleasantries.
Full immunity, James. Deals like that don't come around very often.
She saves herself from prison, but condemns herself to a life on the run from the C-squared.
There won't be any C-squared if she takes the deal and testifies. Why don't you see this?
Abrenio threw his hands in the air. And in the process, she has to testify against a group whose reputation for violent reprisal is second to none.
You know how this game is played, James. You knew what you were getting into when you left your beautiful Holland, Michigan, to get involved in this. At this level, the game is a blood sport, and I think I am being positively generous in my offer for immunity.
I cannot lie to my client. I will not lie to my client.
Fine, don't. Tell her you don't know where they are, or, if you'd prefer, tell her your theory that they were kidnapped. I don't care. All I care about is bringing down the C-squared. All I care about is stopping the spread of their poison across our southern border and staunching the bloodshed.
Abrenio wanted to argue more, but he felt a cloud of defeat looming over him. He didn't know his client well, hell, hardly at all, but he'd seen her concern in her eyes when it came to her kids. I don't think she'll take the deal if it means that her kids will be jeopardized. Grosvenor scowled as she looked at the ceiling.
She'd rather they be in the care of strangers for the rest of their childhood, 'cause that's where they'll be after she's on death row.
Abrenio didn't know what to say. Grosvenor leaned in very close across her desk and lowered her voice to nearly a whisper.
And don't think for a minute that I won't pull every string I can find to make sure that her boys are split up into different institutions. Don't think for an instant that I will hesitate to make the children pay for the crimes of their parents.
Abrenio felt his jaw drop. Who was this monster who'd once been his friend? Grosvenor pushed back to her erect posture and returned to her paperwork.
But you're her lawyer, counselor. You do what you think is best.
The Ballantyne House was like every other house on its cul-de-sac, built in the style of Levittown with a focus on blandness. These one- and two-story houses near Newcastle showed their age. The neighborhood was a hodgepodge of well-kept and decrepit, with chain-link fences dividing yards into precise squares. No one had a garage that Jonathan could see, but the Ballantynes had erected a freestanding pole barn next to their ranch-style house to double as a carport, and that carport stood empty.
"Looks like nobody's home," Gale said from the back seat.
"It's going on noon," Jonathan said. "Everybody must be at work."
Cars were sparse, and no one was outside.
"What do you want me to do?"
Boxers asked.
"We treat it as if it's occupied," Jonathan said. "No shortcuts."
"How do you want to take it?"
Gale asked.
"Quietly," Jonathan said. "No knocking, no crashing. I say we pick the lock."
Boxers gave a dramatic sigh.
"Boring, yet old school."
"Then what?" Gale asked. "If they're in, what do we say?"
"It's not about what we say," Jonathan said. "It's about what we get them to say. Who are they, and what did they do with the boys?"
Jonathan pointed to the empty carport, and Boxers eased the big Suburban into the slot where he dropped the transmission into park.
"Back door?"
"Certainly not the front," Jonathan said. "Let's arm up and get out of sight as soon as possible."
"This is why we're supposed to do this shit at night,"
Boxers grumbled.
"Yeah, well, it's noon,"
Jonathan grumbled back.
In designing the new Batmobile, Jonathan had specced out holsters of sorts beside each of the captain-style chairs. Jonathan lifted his Heckler & Koch MP7 from the holster on the left side of his seat and took it with him as he opened the shotgun seat door. Barely bigger than a large pistol, the MP7 was an amazing firearm. Its 4.6mm bullet left the muzzle at 2,300 feet per second and could give meaningful love to a bad guy at 200 yards. He shrugged the sling over his shoulder and let the weapon dangle by his right hip. If he wasn't careful, the MP7 would clack and rattle against the .45-caliber Colt 1911 on his hip. He settled the bud for his two-way radio into his ear canal and clipped the radio itself onto his belt, just behind the Colt. As they kitted up and left the vehicle, Jonathan led the way to the shelter provided by the bushes near the left rear corner of the house, the green-black corner, as he thought of it. He scanned every compass point for looky-loos, but found no one watching. As Boxers and Gale approached, likewise armed with MP7s, Jonathan keyed his mic.
"Everybody on the channel?"
"I'm here,"
Finiche said from back home. Boxers and Gale said likewise as they donned black tactical gloves. In the near distance, a dog let loose with some fierce barking, causing Jonathan to whirl, but he relaxed when he couldn't see it. The dog was just being a dog. The house defined, unremarkable. The grass was neither long nor short. The facade was entirely flat, made of vinyl siding that showed its age. Waist-high dents spoke to Jonathan of a football tackle that went wrong, a suspicion confirmed by an abandoned football that lay in the yard near the other end of the house. A girl's bicycle rested against the back wall. The structure itself lay in the middle of a long hill. A sliding glass door provided access to the near side, the high side. On the low side, at the far end of the structure, a concrete stairwell sloped down to what Jonathan imagined was a basement door. He verified his suspicion with a quick check. Leaves and other yard trash littered the bottom of the stairwell, where a glass-paneled wooden door gave a glimpse into a dark basement. These were the times when Jonathan missed having a government-funded full-size team. In a perfect world, operators would cover the front and back doors, while other operators concentrated on entry, but that luxury wasn't available to him.
"Gunslinger, cover the back door and try not to look too much like a burglar," Jonathan said. "I'll let you know when we go downstairs, and keep an eye out for nosy neighbors."
He flipped a switch on his radio.
"Go to Vox," he said.
Voice-activated transmission meant that everyone could hear everything everyone else said without having to key a microphone. At this hour, in the light of day, the smart move may well have been merely to knock on the front door and see who answered. The problem with that, though, was the next step. A knock would attract attention. So what would they do if no one came to the door? One way or another, they were going inside, so it would be best not to be seen. So they'd enter like the burglars that he supposed they were. He decided to make entry on the main level because if the Ballantines were home, they would likely be on the top floor, if only because the basement appeared to be dark. It had been a while since he'd broken into a place quietly, and he was aware of his team's attention as he moved to the sliding glass doors. He started by pulling on the handle, in case the door was unlocked. Hey, you never knew. No such luck.
"Remember the technique?"
Boxers asked. Jonathan planted his gloved palms flat against the glass, pressed just hard enough to get traction, and then he wiggled the glass panel up and down in its tracks. He heard the click and knew he was in. That much clearance between the door and the track was enough to dislodge the spring-loaded lock. He looked to Boxers.
"Yes, I do."
As he slid the door open, he lifted his MP7 to his shoulder. He entered what appeared to be a family room. Two sofas met at an L, focused on an old-school big-screen television in the corner. 5 dirty dishes sat on the coffee table. Those were the only signs of current habitation. The television was off.
"Okay, team," he whispered. "Clear so far. Let's go to work."
Jonathan and Big Guy moved through the dimly lit space with smooth and efficient grace. On stage, it might have looked like a modern dance as they moved through the main level of the single-story structure, clearing room after room. As they advanced, they shifted roles, with one person covering the hallway while the other cleared the spaces. In operations where the smart money said that no one was home, the temptation to cut corners on the details could be overwhelming. People got killed when they got lazy, and Jonathan was a tyrant about taking as few chances as possible. If nothing else, a milk run like this provided opportunities to practice moves that they had already performed hundreds, if not thousands, of times. The kitchen hadn't been cleaned in quite some time. Dishes sat in an unsteady stack near the sink, with flatware scattered around the countertop. The dining room was a mismatched collection of cane-backed chairs and a pair of plastic card tables. An array of magazines and mail littered the tabletop. The three bedrooms were a mess, with bunched blankets and sheets atop the mattresses, but there were no people. The closets in the secondary bedrooms were packed with an array of boys' and girls' clothing. A stairwell, protected by swirly wrought iron railings, descended from the middle of the living room floor down into what appeared to be a furnished basement. Clearing the main level took less than 5 minutes.
"We'll want to put the mail in a bag and take it with us,"
Boxers said.
"Not till we clear the basement," Jonathan said. "Gunslinger, we're on our way downstairs. Take a peek through the door window and radio back to me what you find. When you're in place, Big Guy and I will descend from up here."
Jonathan turned to Boxers.
"Any thoughts?"
"To me, it looks like people left in a hurry," he said. "I don't see any signs of a struggle, though."
"I'm not so sure," Jonathan said.
While speaking with Boxers, he'd switched on the white beam at the MP7's muzzle to get a clear view to the bottom of the basement stairs.
"Does that look like a hole in the wall to you?"
Boxers added his light to the spot.
"Looks like somebody took a header off the stairs,"
Gale's voice said. "I'm in place at the basement door. I don't have a view here. It looks like a mudroom on the other side. There are marks on the floor that may be blood."
"Can you make an entry without alerting the neighborhood?"
"I think so," she said. 3 seconds later, Jonathan heard the sound of breaking glass. "Doors open." Jonathan smiled.
"Big Guy and I are coming down the main stairs."
Jonathan led the way.
He hated stairwells, especially open ones like this. They were perfect kill zones. Whether ascending or descending, you revealed yourself a little at a time, and a patient killer needed only to wait for the perfect sight picture, then press the trigger. It was more unnerving going down than going up. Something about having his legs shot out from under him and then falling into a headshot. While ascending, at least you had a better chance of seeing the shooter and making a fight of it. The basement was unusually dark, given the time of day. The Venetian blinds were all down and spun shut. Jonathan almost wished he'd opted for night vision.
He swept his muzzle light in a circle, taking in as much data as would register, all the while staying focused on the red dot of his sight. At his first chance, he squatted low and scanned to his left and right. He was relieved to see the glow of Gunslinger's flashlight bathing the room in intense white light from a different angle.
"You're clear to come down,"
Gale's voice whispered through his earbud.
"Roger that,"
Jonathan whispered back. When he got to the bottom of the stairs, in front of the divot that had been taken out of the wall, he dropped to one knee and added his light and firepower to Gale's. The space down here showed no more love than the rooms upstairs. A ping-pong table took up half the space, and an air hockey table took up the rest. Another old-school big screen sat in the corner, with a couple of ratty, upholstered chairs scattered in front of it. From his position, he could see three interior doors, all of them open and dark.
"I'm down,"
Big Guy whispered in his earbud.
"Let's clear the rooms," Jonathan said.
2 minutes later, they were done. The house was officially empty.
"We're clear," Jonathan said.
He returned his attention to the hole in the wall. Now that he had the time to look more closely, he saw that the divot was actually in two parts, a torso and a head. Somebody had hit this spot hard.
"Somebody definitely tried to fly,"
Boxers observed. Jonathan pointed to the edge of the head divot.
"That looks like blood to me," he said.
Big Guy shined his light on the floor at the bottom of the stairs.
"Here's some more."
There wasn't a lot of it, but someone had clearly been hurt here.
"Hey," Gale called from the far side of the basement, "we missed a door."
Jonathan's heart skipped as he pivoted away from the stairs.
"How'd we do that?"
"This rolling clothes rack was in front of it," Gale said.
"God damn it,"
Jonathan spat. This was the kind of shit that got operators killed. You jump to conclusions and you miss stuff. The chance that the space behind the door might be occupied was still small, but now they'd lost any notion of surprise. When the three of them were gathered at the door, weapons up, Jonathan nodded to Big Guy, who turned the knob and pushed the hollow core panel open onto an unfinished part of the basement.
"Oh, God!"
Gale exclaimed. Boxers grumbled,
"Oh, Christ!"
He slapped at the switch on the wall and brought the area into high relief. Blood splashes and spatters smeared every surface from the floor to the walls to the side of the washing machine.
"Good God," Jonathan said. "Looks like they killed pigs in here."
He pulled his phone from his pocket and took a picture. This part of the basement looked as if maybe the owners considered making improvements, but then changed their minds. Storage shelves stretched from floor to ceiling, and they were packed with household crap, from lawn gear to Christmas ornaments. The blood was mostly concentrated near an unenclosed toilet and sink, and it still was wet, though sticky.
"Kill the lights and let's get out of here,"
Gale said.
"This is a crime scene. We don't need our DNA to be part of the lab results."
Jonathan didn't worry about that. And Gale shouldn't have. Given the work they had done over the years on behalf of Uncle Sam, they had no official records.
"Keep the lights where they are," Jonathan said. "What do you think happened?"
"Somebody was killed here,"
Boxers said.
"My money says it was the Ballantines."
"Where are the bodies?"
Jonathan asked.
"Took them out,"
Boxers said.
"There are no blood trails across the floor out there."
"You said there's blood inside the door, though,"
Boxers recalled. His tone turned argumentative. Gale scowled.
"I saw this once at a murder scene," she said. "The killer wrapped his victim up in a carpet to get her out of the house, but when he put the carpet down to open the door, some of the blood leaked out."
"Was that a crime of passion?"
Jonathan said. Gale made a puffing noise.
"Anything but. He was a very organized serial killer."
"You arrested him then?"
Boxers said.
"Ate a gun when we were pulling up his driveway."
"Better than a needle, I suppose,"
Jonathan said.
"But not nearly as satisfying,"
Boxers said. Jonathan placed his hands on his hips and surveyed the gore.
"This is a lot of blood," he said. "But I don't see the fountain spray of, say, a cut throat, nor the spatter of a gunshot."
"You're thinking torture, aren't you?"
Boxers asked.
"The thought occurred to me, yes."
"Hey, look here,"
Gale said. She wandered a bit into a deeper, shadowy part of the storage area and focused her flashlight beam on a pair of cane-backed chairs that looked a lot like the ones they saw around the dining room table upstairs.
"They're covered in blood."
"Get a picture,"
Jonathan said. He was beginning to agree that maybe it was time to be someplace else.
And there, Gale said, pointing.
Jonathan couldn't see what she was looking at, and there wasn't enough room for him to slide in next to her. She snapped a picture with her phone.
Bloody duct tape, she said.
These poor assholes were tortured,
Boxer said. He pointed to a spot deeper into the space.
Is that a kid's bedroom slipper I see, covered in blood?
Ah, Jesus, Jonathan moaned. I think they killed the whole family and took the bodies away.
Gale said,
But why?
She cut her question short as the ceiling creaked. Boxer slapped the room light off, and they all froze.
Mother Hen, Jonathan whispered, are you on the channel?
It took a few seconds for Venice to answer. In that time, Jonathan pulled a dental mirror from a pouch on his left sleeve and cracked open the door to the rest of the basement to look back at the stairs.
Go ahead, Scorpion, Venice said.
Jonathan whispered,
We're not alone here. Have you been monitoring the local emergency channels?
As I always do, she said. I've heard no dispatches to your location.
Raj, Jonathan said.
Stay tuned.
Monitoring emergency responses and dispatching channels was becoming more complicated and less reliable as public safety nets moved toward encryption. With his rifle up and ready, Jonathan killed his muzzle light and pushed the door open the rest of the way and sidestepped out into the playroom.
I'll cover the stairway, Jonathan whispered.
We'll leave through the back door. They're gonna have the Batmobile covered, Boxer said. We should engage in here.
And I think we should get the hell out,
Jonathan said, without taking his eyes off the stairs. He motioned over his shoulder toward the back door.
Move.
Moving,
Boxers and Gale said together. Jonathan saw a splash of white light against the base of the stairs, and then creaking as someone descended.
I've got movement on the stairs,
Jonathan whispered.
White light.
He dropped to a classic kneeling marksman position. He sat on his right heel while he locked his left elbow into his left knee to brace his aim. He welded his cheek to the stock and lined up behind his red dot sight.
I have movement outside the back door,
Boxer said. These guys were coordinating their attack. They were demonstrating a disturbing level of sophistication. As the light descended the stairs, a second one joined it. Through his peripheral vision, Jonathan saw a gunslinger backing up a few paces and knew that she was taking a pivot position from which she could cover either the back door or the stairwell. Jonathan heard male voices from the steps, speaking in a language he didn't understand. It sounded Eastern European to his ear.
Did you hear that?
Jonathan whispered.
They're stacking up in the back, too, Boxer said. And yes, I heard it. We're shooting, right?
If they've got guns, we shoot, Jonathan said. If they were cops, they'd send dogs.
God, he hoped that was true. The team on the stairs started their descent after what sounded like a countdown from three. It was the rhythm of the language.
It's happening,
Jonathan said. The attackers' muzzle lights bounced around the far wall. Then they surged forward, four of them streaming down to the base where they split into two elements, two button-hooked left toward Jonathan. They crossed in front of Jonathan's red dot, and he dropped them both with one shot each to the ear. To his left, out of sight at the back door, wood and glass splintered, and the area around the exit erupted in three quick bursts of suppressed gunfire. Jonathan tuned that out and shifted his aim to the right toward the other pair of muzzle lights. These two posed a real threat to Digger, who had neither cover nor concealment. If their sights acquired him, he'd be an easy kill. He thumbed his selector from single fire to auto fire and let loose with 3 5-round bursts. The flashlights dropped to the floor.
Four down, maybe more,
Jonathan said, as he turned his muzzle light back on and advanced on his AOR, area of responsibility. If Boxers and Gale had lost on their side, he'd know soon enough, but he needed to make sure that the threat he'd just neutralized stayed that way.
"We've got three,"
Boxers said. Gale added, "Big Guy and I are going outside to make sure there aren't more." After a beat, she added, "Oh my God, they're police officers." Jonathan's insides tensed. Could this be the shit show of all shit shows? That was for later. Now he had a job to finish. He kept his attention focused on the guys in the shadows. He knew that the first two he shot were dead, but these last guys could be playing possum. His goal wasn't to finish off any who were alive, but rather to disarm them and make sure that they could do no more harm. There were only two on this side, and both were toast, and they wore the uniforms of police officers.
Shit! Stay focused, Johnny boy.
Jonathan looked at the patch on their shoulders, but he didn't recognize the jurisdiction. He took 30 seconds to get pictures of their faces, badges, and patches, careful to stay out of the spreading gore.
"Hey, team, we need to get out of here,"
Jonathan said as he stooped to get a better angle on a dead man's face.
"We're clear outside,"
Boxers said. "We're moving to the Batmobile," Gale said. "Oh my God, what did we do?" Jonathan pocketed his phone and headed for the door.
"We didn't get murdered," he said. "Hey, Slinger, give me a hand."
One of the attackers who'd stacked up at the door had fallen half outside, and Jonathan wanted to drag him all the way in so the door would close. As he grabbed the collar on the dead guy's shirt, he noted with interest that the corpse was not wearing body armor. That spoke to the level of threat they were expecting. When the body's feet were clear of the door by 15 inches or so, he let it drop to the tile floor. Gale stared at the carnage, her eyes glistening.
"Come on, Gale," Jonathan whispered. "We need to not be here."
They moved without further words to the waiting vehicle and climbed inside. Rubbing his eyes, Jonathan stretched his back, first left, then right. The one to the right launched a ripple of cracks that sounded like popcorn.
"Hey, big guy," he said. "We need to plot a course to Shenandoah Station, the kid's next stop after here. I have no idea what this is all about, but it can't be good for the people there."